This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This is a special Bits and Pieces episode. Longtime listeners know how this goes. When we have a major holiday, like Memorial Day, we take the week off to be with our family and friends. Instead of an episode in the regular format, we publish an episode with pre-recorded segments from our hosts, contributors, and even listeners like you. We call them Bits and Pieces episodes. This time, it's a Bits and Pieces to cover 2 weeks off, so it's a bit longer than our usual episodes. Actually, it's a lot longer. But hey, you've got 2 weeks to listen. Here's what we have for you. Brian talks about his flight on Avello with Micah. Launchpad's interview with Redbird Flight Simulation's Josh Harnagle, Vice President of Marketing. I catch up with Nikki about her flying adventures. A conversation with Sandy Sanderson about the Covert Ravens program. Launchpad's interview with Hank Coates, CEO of the Commemorative Air Force, and CAF's Nancy McGee, Vice President of Education. Also, my interview with Major Danny Gill from the United States Air Force Aerial Targets Squadron. Then Dennis Klotz and Trent McMillan on the Flying Musicians Association. And finally, a commentary from Micah about sustainable jet fuel. All right, let's get started. First up, we've recently talked about the new ultra-low-cost carrier Avello. Brian Coleman recently flew on Avello, and he describes his experience to Micah.
Hey, it's your main man, Micah, and we're back with
Brian. And boy, did that sound fake. Yeah, so this is Brian, and it seems like we're getting ready to do our own weekly podcast at this point over travel experiences.
Well, I certainly hope not, but nonetheless. Yes. And we're back with Pasadena, Brian, former associate producer from the Airplane Geeks. And we have another trip report for you. And this is really kind of a unique trip report that was sort of mentioned on the show earlier because it was in the show notes. And you flew with a new airline. What airline is that? In fact, how do you pronounce that airline?
It looks like it should be pronounced Avlo, but they actually pronounce it Avello.
I was never sure if it was Avello or Avello, but either way, you're a fine fellow to do a trip report with.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, and it's kind of fun that they're headquartered out of Burbank. And for those people that don't know U.S. geography, Pasadena and Burbank are two adjacent cities. So by far, it's significantly easier for me to get to Burbank Airport than it is LAX, where I normally fly out of. With the launch of the new airline, I thought I'd give them a try and see what the experience was like.
And if you're from my generation, you hear the name of that town, Burbank, and you hear beautiful downtown Burbank in your head from laughing. Now, Avello is a limited low-cost carrier, an ultra-low-cost carrier, in fact, and they only have a few destinations. When did you fly them, Brian, and why did you decide to go and take a flight on Avello?
Really, the only reason why I decided to fly them is because they had a $19 fare. And they had a few of their various destinations. They're supporting sort of secondary or tertiary markets. So, yeah, not necessarily the most popular places on the planet, but many of the major airlines have pulled out of these secondary markets. And Avello has seen this as an opportunity. I guess one could even say Burbank is a secondary market compared to LAX. We're very, very close, but still, it's an underserved market, and going to other places just makes it a whole lot easier. So my original plan was to fly from Burbank to Grand Junction, Colorado.
That's a beautiful place. Now, that was your original plan. So I'm guessing that when you say your original plan means that something happened and there was another plan.
Yeah, so I thought I was being smart here, and I booked my ticket for the second day of flight. So Avella's been flying for about 3 weeks now, and they just started service this past Monday, going from Burbank to Grand Junction. So, and they don't fly every day, so it's a Monday, Wednesday, Friday route for them. So I thought I would be smart and book my ticket on Wednesday just to avoid any possible issues. However, when I get to the airport, I was greeted by an agent that said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. You're going to Grand Junction. We've canceled that flight because of a mechanical." Now, one of the other challenges with launching an airline and Avella, with their limited capacity right now, they only have 3 aircraft. So it's kind of hard to pull another aircraft out of maintenance or, you know, move other equipment around to get a flight to go where it's going. So they just canceled the one and only flight for the day. The person at the ticket counter was phenomenally nice and said, "We're quite happy to reaccommodate you on another day. For example, if you want to go on Friday, we're quite happy to do that." And I looked at her and boy, did I confuse her with what I said next, which was, "So where's your next flight going to?" And she said, "Well, our next flight today is going to Santa Rosa." I said, "Great. Can you move me on the flight to Santa Rosa?" And she looked at me and said, "But you were going to Grand Junction." I said, "Yeah, that's okay. I'll go to Santa Rosa instead." She said, "But you were going to Grand Junction." I said, "Yeah, it's okay. If you notice on my ticket, I was returning today, so I really don't care where I'm going. I just want to go on your flight and experience it and come back. So as long as the Santa Rosa flight comes back today, I'm good."
Makes sense to me. I mean, after all, if you don't know where you're going, you'll probably end up someplace else.
And then I got there. So to me, it really didn't matter if I went to Grand Junction or I went to Santa Rosa, and they were phenomenally accommodating in ultimately getting me there. But there was a challenge along the way as well.
Challenge along the way? That doesn't sound promising.
Well, it's one of those things where you're a brand new airline and you have a brand new reservation system and you're trying to get things launched and, well, you kind of run into problems along the way.
Now, I had heard something about when Avella first opened up the reservation system, they managed to take down 3 or 4 different airlines at the same time with a crash. Is this what we're talking about?
Yes and no. I've heard the story a little bit differently, but the GDS, I think that stands for Global Distribution System, the network that airlines use to book, there are a few companies, probably the most popular one that people know about is Sabre, and I believe American Airlines owns them, or at least they used to years ago. And a daughter company of theirs called Radix is the company that Avella uses to really manage the sale of tickets. And the fine folks at Cranky Flyer, Brett wrote a really good article a little bit ago about the crash of the Red X system and how it affected, I believe, 30 or so global carriers. And they were down for 3 or 4 days because of whatever system issue they had. And when you're launching an airline like Avella, losing your ability to sell tickets really creates some problems. Although I didn't have an issue buying my ticket, I certainly had an issue when the representative went to change my ticket at the airport because they couldn't actually do it at the airport because they're still experiencing some problems. So although you could go to the website and buy a ticket, their systems at the airport, as I said, are still having some problems. So she actually put me on the phone with a representative in the call center who took my information, and I had to go through and explain to her what I was trying to do. And I completely confused her again by changing destinations. But she took down my number and said she'd call me back in a few minutes. And a few minutes later, she did indeed call me back and said that I was booked on the flight to Santa Rosa. And for those that aren't familiar with Santa Rosa, it's a beautiful town in Northern California, and it's where Charles Schulz used to live. And Charles Schulz is the author of the Peanuts comic strip. So Snoopy and Charlie Brown. And it was great being able to see the airport because I always heard that there was the Peanuts motif at the Santa Rosa airport. And it was great fun being able to check that out and see if all the rumors I heard about the airport were true.
Now, Santa Rosa, that's a few hundred miles north of our friend Max Trescott, isn't it? Did you have a chance to call him and tell him, hey, come to the airport and meet me for lunch? Pop into your Cirrus and meet me there.
Yeah, I would have, except the turnaround time was about 40 minutes. So when you deplane, because the airport's so small, there's no terminal building that you go into per se. You have to deplane, go into baggage claim, then you have to go through security again, and then go into a temporary tent structure, which is the departure lounge, to board the plane. And by the time I did all that, deplaned, walked through boarding, went through TSA, which there's two people in front of me at TSA, which is really nice going into these secondary markets. And I got to the waiting room. They had already started to board the flight. So the flight attendants were able to get the plane spruced up and ready to go to take me back to Burbank. So no, sadly, I was not able to see or talk with Max.
Well, you know, Avelo is an ultra low cost carrier, the ULCC, and ULCCs have a bad reputation for a lot of good reasons sometimes. But one of the things that Avelo does that I just love is that, you know, they are charging for, well, all ultra low cost carriers charge for checked bags and some charge for carry-on bags, but Avelo seems to have it right. They're charging $10 for checked bags. What a deal! But they're charging $30 for carry-on bags because they know if you're bringing a carry-on on the plane, it's going to slow them down.
Exactly. Now, they really didn't have that problem of having to charge people for carry-on bags because both segments had about 40 people on board. So there was plenty of overhead space and there was plenty of social distancing on the flight. But you're absolutely right. I think under normal times, under a normal flight, I would really hate the idea of having to pay $35 to bring my bag on board. However, given the $19 fare compared to what other airlines charge going between Los Angeles and San Francisco, it still is a phenomenally inexpensive deal. And only charging $10 to put it in the belly of the plane, also a really good deal.
Now, you said there were only 40 people on board. Now, Avelo flies 737-800s. They have a capacity of like 190 passengers. It must have been wonderful. What was it like room-wise, and how would you have felt if you were packed in?
Well, one of their business models is how they have the plane configured. So the normal seat pitch is 28 inches, which is really, really tiny. However, they have other seats that have a tad bit more legroom that goes, I believe, all the way up to 35 inches. And they charge based on the quantity of legroom that you have. And of course, exit rows have a bit more legroom. They charge for those as well. They charge a separate fee for if you're sitting at the front of the plane versus the back of the plane. I found it really interesting. When I went to buy the ticket, you could buy the ticket, and one of the steps along the process is to choose your seat. And they give you a seat map, and it's very, very clear over what seat you can pick and how much it would cost for that seat. But you could also choose not to get a seat at all. And then it turns into a roulette game when you get to the airport as to what seat they'll assign you. And just wanting to pay the $19 for my fare, I wanted to try my luck and see how things were going to go. And I actually got a middle tier seat. So it wasn't the least expensive center seat, which I was expecting that they normally charge $4 for that seat in the back of the plane. They actually gave me a $16 seat through my random selection. So I sort of felt as though I was lucky in that regard that I got an upgrade for free.
Well, you're a first-class guy normally, and they must have spotted that on you right away. But you know, what sort of surprises me is that if they had all this room, I mean, probably close to 120 empty seats, wouldn't they try to put everybody in the best seats possible so they all have a really good experience so that they come back to Avelo at a later time?
I'm not sure during these COVID times that that would have been a smart thing to do. So I think having passengers spaced out reasonably was a good idea. I also think that they want to reinforce to passengers that you pay for the seat that you get. And I think from a weight and balance issue, I'm not sure if you'd want all of the passengers in one section of the plane as well. But being so light, again, I don't know if that really would have made much of a difference.
So how was the flight? What was it like on there? Did you get served food? Do they charge?
There was no food service. However, I was very surprised. They came across with a snack pack. So there was a bottle of water, a package of Lorna Doone cookies, one of my favorites, and a sanitizing wipe that was all in a package. And they actually handed those out for free. I was really expecting them to charge for water or soft drinks or anything, and they didn't. So that was really a nice, pleasant surprise. They did not offer food for sale nor any other beverages. So you really had a choice of this water snack pack thing or nothing at all. And pretty much everyone that I saw ended up taking the pack. So that was, I think, a nice touch on their part.
It sounds nice. And what were you, I mean, were you comfortable? How long a flight is it?
It was a little over, I think, 50 minutes. It was booked, I think, for an hour and 15 minutes, but they tend to pad the schedules these days a little bit. So actual flight time, yeah, certainly under an hour. So that was fine. And kind of like flying on Southwest, I don't mind being in such a small seat for a flight that's under an hour. It's really not much of a problem. And when no one's sitting next to you, really everyone had the entire robe for themselves, unless if they were traveling with someone. I didn't notice anyone have the courage to spread out on their own, but I think the way they had the aircraft organized, no one really needed to.
Sounds like it was a good time. Now, some of the other destinations that Avelo flies are Bozeman, Montana, which is actually the gateway to Yellowstone Park, mm-hmm. and Ogden, Salt Lake City, Utah, and Grand Junction, as you mentioned. They also go into Phoenix, up into Washington State, into the Pasco Tri-County Airport. Mm-hmm. You can get into Redmond, Oregon, and Redding. So some of the flights, you know, might run maybe a couple of hours, but it sounds like most of them are pretty short hops.
Yeah, and I think if I were to take the flight to Bozeman, I'd probably pay the extra money to have the extra legroom. But being new configuration of an aircraft, the seats were certainly comfortable as a slimline seat can be. Yeah, I didn't have a problem with it. But again, for a longer flight, just me personally, I'd probably pay the extra money to have a little bit more space.
Now, how many – is it one flight a day that they go up from Burbank to Santa Rosa, or one flight a day to all of these airports, or is it multiple times?
I think for Santa Rosa, because of the demand, they have two flights a day. To Grand Junction, they only had one flight. As they get more experience, they're going to be building out their network. But for right now, it's either one or two flights a day to each of the destinations. And with only three aircraft servicing so many destinations, you kind of have to do that.
Well, speaking of building out their network, you know, we mentioned Cranky Flyer before. Cranky had a great article on his website. It was May 10th, and it talks about Avelo has also announced that they're going to be starting service on the East Coast out of New Haven, Connecticut, in Tweed Airport, a tiny little airport right on Long Island Sound in Connecticut, just north of New York City, that currently only has American Eagle service, that's regional service, to Philadelphia. That's it. And while Avelo hasn't announced where they're flying to, Cranky's assumption, and it's a great article, I highly encourage you to read it, is that they're probably going to be going to Florida. And he suspects they're going to be pulling a lot of people out of the Northeast because there ought to be some great rates, and it's a good location.
Yeah, in addition to that, they're putting $1.2 million into the airport. So I think the expansion at the airport itself is going to be great. And I think the service for the folks in Eastern New York and the Connecticut area are really going to appreciate not having to go to JFK, LaGuardia, or God forbid, Newark. Sorry, I'm from New Jersey, so I get to make fun of them. Those airports. So I think this is actually a really good opportunity for Avelo. And while I was on the plane, I asked the flight attendants if they knew anything about the route structure and if there were going to be any east-west flights, because I would really like to try them out for that, because I have a really good friend that lives in Connecticut. And well, actually, Max Flight lives in Connecticut, so I could kill two birds with one stone here and see my friend and Max and do it with Avelo. So I'm really looking forward to seeing if they will do any east-west routes.
I think that would be great. And if they don't do the east-west route, then we just, Max, you hear this, Mr. Flight? You're just going to have to drive down to Tweed Airport and give us a trip report on a Velo to Florida.
There you go.
So you said you were speaking with the flight attendants. They must be new to this. They may be new flight attendants, or they might have come over from another airline. What was it like? Did you have any? Did you have a chance to talk to any of them, really?
I did, especially since there were so few people on the airplane. I took the opportunity to get up and talk with them. Two of the flight attendants were kind enough to spend some time with me. One of them was actually a furloughed flight attendant who formerly flew on United, was based in Miami. So she actually moved from Miami to the Los Angeles area for this job. And I thought that was great and really interesting. Another woman was formerly in the hospitality business. She worked at a restaurant and saw the opportunity to be a flight attendant and decided to leave her job being a waitress and become a flight attendant. And I asked him about the process because I thought being an experienced flight attendant versus a brand new flight attendant would be different. And they actually said no. They both went through the same 2-week training class in Florida. So it didn't matter about their previous experience.
Wow. Now, did you have a chance by any means to get onto the flight deck and talk to the pilots?
Unfortunately, no. That, of course, was one of my questions and kind of a disappointment of the flight. When I first boarded the aircraft, I asked if I could talk with the flight crew, and they said that the flight attendant said they're quite busy getting prepared for takeoff, but possibly when we landed, they would have time to talk with me. And when we landed back at Burbank, I asked if they could spend some time, and they never opened the door. So never up in Santa Rosa, they never greeted the passengers or said goodbye to the passengers. And then in Burbank, they kept the door closed. So I'm not sure if it's because I had asked to talk with them that they kept the door closed, or if it's just company policy, or they were busy writing up whatever. But that was certainly a disappointment in the flight.
So you've had this experience. It sounds like overall it was pleasant. Do you think you'll fly them again? Might you call up Mr. Trescott and say, hey, I'm coming up. Let's have lunch?
Yeah, I absolutely would. I was surprised over I guess I shouldn't have been surprised over the newness of the aircraft, because I believe all three aircraft that they have are brand new. And even if they're not, it doesn't matter, because they were completely, it looks like they were completely gutted and retrofitted. So they looked like they were new aircraft. The flight attendants were phenomenally pleasant. The gate agents were super nice. The people at the ticket counter, although they had what I would like to chalk up as growing pains because of the issue with Radix, they had their challenges. But again, they were super nice and just pleasant people to be around, unlike some of my other experiences with legacy carriers. Going into secondary airports might be a challenge for people, but certainly if you wanted to check out the wine region in Northern California, either be in Napa or Sonoma, and you live around the Burbank area, they're an excellent choice, and I wouldn't hesitate in recommending them, and I look forward to actually flying them again sometime.
Well, can't wait to hear about that one, and maybe we'll be able to do this again sometime soon.
Sounds good. Looking forward to it.
Hey, for the airplane geeks, this is your main man, Micah.
And I guess I get to call myself now a contributor at large. This is Brian.
We'll talk to you all later.
And fly safely.
Reporter-at-large Launchpad Marzari visited Redbird Flight Simulations in Austin, Texas, and spoke with Josh Harnagel, Vice President of Marketing.
Hey, Airplane Geeks, Reporter-at-large Launchpad Marzari. The world of flight simulation, if you start digging into the rules, gets really confusing really fast. And you're like, wait, I can do this, but I can't do that, and this doesn't count? And what makes the difference? So to clear all that up, I flew down here to Redbird in Austin, Texas, and I'm with
Josh Harnagel.
And Josh, let's talk about the flight simulator world, because I'm confused. Let's start clearing the mud up. At the bottom level, there's the Microsoft Flight Simulator and X-Plane, which we all love, but that doesn't count, right?
That's right. So those are not qualified by the FAA or any foreign or international CAA, Civil Aviation Authority, to count towards training. But my big asterisk on all of this is it's still valuable. It may not go in the logbook, but if you can shoot an approach on Microsoft Flight Sim at home before you actually go out and do it in the airplane, there's probably some value in that still.
All right. Now, the FAA breaks out. The next one is flight training devices, and then they have 1 through 7, but, subbed of that. But what's a flight training device?
So a flight training device is a we'd call them a simulator. It's something you'd probably see in a flight school. And typically, nowadays, they're level 4 through 7. And they used to do some of the lower levels, but that's been replaced by an AATD, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But the FTD is really built around a specific aircraft type, like a 172 or a King Air or something like that. And it's used oftentimes in a university training program or somebody training a Part 142 training program like SIMCOM. The requirements on those are a little more onerous on the operator of the simulator, so they've kind of fallen out of favor for most general aviation training.
Okay, and these are desktop devices.
No, not necessarily. They can be enclosed with big projectors, that kind of thing. And the FTD specification doesn't really say that it's a desktop device or a larger device. In fact, most of the FTDs that you see now are larger full cockpit simulators.
All right. Well, let's step up the progression ladder here and go to an aviation training device, which I guess now, like everything, has to come in different flavors.
Yeah, so the aviation training device is actually kind of on par with the FTD, especially the lower level FTDs. In 2008, I believe the FAA came up with a way for simulator manufacturers to self-qualify their devices, and as long as the end user didn't change anything, that qualification stays in place, which makes the burden of owning a simulator and having to go to the National Simulator Program every year to get it requalified and all that you have to do with an FTD much easier, and it really opened up the market and made simulator training way more accessible. And there's two flavors of that. There's a basic aviation training device, and there's an advanced aviation training device.
Of course, because we've got to make it more complicated.
Yeah, exactly. And so the basic aviation training device tends to be more of a desktop unit. A lot of times individual pilots own them because you can fly your 6 approaches in 6 months, log it for your instrument currency requirements. And then an ATD or an AATD, advanced aviation training device, tends to be more for flight schools, universities, that kind of thing, that are engaged in the business of flight training.
Okay, let's to the basic one where you said log your 6 approaches. Is there a record? Do you have to have it modemed in so that you get credit for it? How does that work?
At this point, what you need to do is just put it in your logbook, note the approach, and note that it was flown in a BATD or an AATD, and that just like if you went out in the airplane and flew an approach in actual, it counts. So there's no third party that needs to be involved in certifying it.
Okay, so it's on the honor system. Just like if you went and floated, you wrote it in your logbook. We trust the FAA saying you're being an honest person. Okay. Now, the advanced training or the advanced aviation training device, boy, don't you just love all these acronyms. All right, let's step up the ladder here and let's go to full flight sims. What's a full flight sim?
So a full flight sim is probably what you think about when you think about airline flight simulators. It's a huge contraption with 6 legs on hydraulic or electrically pneumatic actuated jacks. That's got a full cockpit, big projector screens inside. And those, like everything, have different levels. But those are what, your professional pilots train on. You can get a type certificate inside of a level D full flight simulator without ever stepping in the real airplane. And so when you hear the stories about The first time I ever flew the airplane with I had passengers in the back, that's where that comes from, is they were training in a full flight simulator before they got on the line.
Okay, in a full flight simulator, you've heard us, listeners, let's get geeky for a moment, 6 degrees of motion. Those 6 degrees are what you normally expect, which is roll, pitch, and yaw, which are the first three. But then you have X, Y, and Z, which is the ability to move the entire simulation platform straight up, forward and back, and left and right in level. You know, those are the other three. So that brings up, we're back to what Redbird makes. You make full motion, or you make motion simulators, and you do 3 degrees of control.
Yeah, so we built our advanced aviation training device, the flagship simulator, the MCX or the FMX, with the idea that we wanted to have a balance of easy to qualify, easy to get credit for a flight school without having to do yearly renewals, but make the training as effective as possible in that framework. So we include things that are not required, things like wraparound visuals, more avionics and more panel configurations that are required by the FAA, and motion, because we think motion in particular has a lot of value for new pilots, new instrument pilots, and it really helps sell the realism of the flight for sure.
But again, there's a, when you go to that 6 degree, there the cost just goes up exponentially. Start moving the decimal place two or three positions to the right.
Yeah, exactly. There's not a really cheap way to do 6 degrees of freedom, and at that level, there's also a bunch of requirements around visuals, and that's one of the things as we explored that really makes the cost go up, because you have to have these huge mirrors to reflect images off and commingulate them, so it gets pretty expensive pretty quick.
Now, you make more practical simulators for like flight schools that don't require like huge amounts of HVAC.
Yeah, one of the main requirements that we saw when we came into the industry is we wanted a simulator that we could put inside a regular classroom. It fit through a standard size door, it'd run off wall power, 110, could run on carpet, 8-foot ceiling, and could be assembled by two or three people in about a day. And so that's really that, you know, those sort of fences were what we designed around. So yeah, you could put it in just about any room in a normal building. It goes through a normal size door.
No special weight requirements on the floor, no ceiling, you know, fire or any of that stuff. That makes it pretty convenient. Now, who's your target audience?
So we really run the gamut across aviation. We have stuff that's for people that are just into flight sim, not even real pilots. Through, you know, you're an instrument rated private pilot and you want to stay current at home, we have a simulator product for that. But then the large sims are really for flight schools, universities, airlines, smaller airlines, flight departments, that kind of thing. Because we also, in addition to your standard GA fleet, your 172s and Barons, we have simulators for King Airs and Caravans and Cessna Mustangs and Citations and that kind of thing.
Now, that's an important, we hinted upon that earlier, is that if you build a simulator to be a King Air 300, it's certified for a King Air 300. You can't suddenly get credit for flying using it to train for a King Air 800.
Yeah, so the AATD, the Advanced Aviation Training Device qualification level, allows for different configurations. So our King Air, for example, we have like a King Air 350 that can do different avionics packages. But yes, if we're doing a King Air 200, the switches are different. Everything's different about it. So that's kind of a different simulator at that level. When you get at the lower, you know, 172s, Pipers, Beechcrafts, those can be interchangeable inside the same simulator.
Well, and that gets back to the fact that when you fly your 6 approaches, it doesn't say that you have to fly them in your airplane. You just have to fly them in a IFR-certified airplane.
Right. Yeah, for most Part 91 flying, it's all about category and class, airplane, single engine, land, that kind of thing. And that's the level of certification or qualification that's required for the AATD. It's category and class.
Let's talk about manipulating knobs. Mm-hmm. Does The FAA seems to be very concerned about how you interface with the controls.
Yeah, so that's one of the main kind of lines in the sand about whether a unit or a device could be qualified to get credit is whether you're using, I think they refer to it as computer hardware, computer input devices to control the simulator. So if you're using a mouse, something like that, it's not going to be able to be qualified. But if you can touch a knob or touch a screen and that interacts with the avionics, then that's kind of the line you have to do across.
How's production going? We just walked through your facility here, and it seems like you're just cranking on it. Are you making to order, or do you have can people just buy one off the shelf?
Yeah, actually, since about May or June of last year, we've been just cranking, super busy. Depending on which unit you're looking at, some of them we might be, like the J, we might be able to ship you in about 2 weeks. But the larger sims, there's, I think, an 8 or 9 week backlog on those. And they're, as soon as we have a production slot open, we sell it.
So you're booked out for like the rest of the summer and the year as far as production?
Yeah, I think we're booking now into late August, early September.
Oh, that's great. Anything that helps, Okay, and we've just been walking through the facilities, and this is all manufactured locally here in Austin, right?
Yeah, we actually do. We have a few subcontractors, but they're all in the Austin area, and we do all the final assembly of all the products here in-house in our facility here. The steel for the motion platforms is actually made in Indianapolis and shipped down, ready to be assembled. But other than that, it's all done in-house.
And that includes, we saw where you were sending parts out to get them powder coated and painted.
Yes, yeah. We'll do powder coating here locally in Austin. We assemble our own circuit boards, wire harnesses, all that kind of stuff in-house.
You mentioned earlier that you've done sales to schools and colleges for multiple of like the J simulators.
Yeah, one of the really interesting things over the last few years has been the expansion of aviation inside middle and high schools, programs for teaching STEM, math, science, technology topics. And it's becoming a really big part of a lot of these STEM programs. And so the J simulator, which is a desktop, not FAA approved, but that means you can do a lot of stuff with it. Simulator has become really popular in that space, and we'll send, there's school districts that'll buy 12, 15, 20, 50 of them and create aviation laboratories for their district or for their school.
And the difference being is a J simulator is an industrial strength, yoke and control stuff. So unlike consumer grade stuff, which may not handle the young kids banging on it constantly, this is more a sturdy product.
Yeah, we actually built a specific version of the J for schools and public institutions where they'd get a lot of hard use. The other nice thing about it is it's all in one. It's monitor, computer, controls, all in one box. You don't have to mix and match parts. You don't have to install any software. It all comes ready to go. So setup is like 10 minutes. You plug it in and it's good. The other nice thing about it if you have a school with 30 of them in your laboratory, if one of them breaks, you can ship it back and we'll ship you a new one depending on your warranty and all that kind of stuff. So it's not like you're dealing with multiple manufacturers of different components that you have to try to sort out what's breaking and what's the problem.
Especially integrating software into your third-party product. Here it's a single package. Well, we've been looking at what you have been doing. Anything coming down the pipeline?
Yeah, we're actually working on a really exciting new project that is really for individual pilots. It's not really targeted at flight schools, and I think there's a lot of we're just really excited about it, and I think at Oshkosh this year we'll be able to announce it and talk about it a lot more.
Oh, AirVenture.
I've missed it. I've missed it for sure.
Well, there you go, listeners. We're down here at Redbird getting excited about flight sims. Well, Josh, this has been great. Thank you for hosting us. If our listeners want to know more, where would they go?
So go to www.redbirdflight.com, and you got all the information you need.
There you go, listeners. Flight simulation, it's so cool. We'd like to thank Redbird for hosting us. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, frequency change approved. Good day.
As many of you know, I volunteered with Sun and Fun Radio at the Sun and Fun Aerospace Expo in 2021 as a reporter. I roamed the event, recording interviews that were broadcast locally on 1510 AM and streamed worldwide on liveatc.net/SNF. I caught up with Airplane Geek's contributor, Nikki.
This is Max Flight from the Airplane Geeks podcast. This week I'm on special assignment for Sun and Fun Radio, reporting from Sun and Fun 21. And I'm here with Nikki. Now, one of the things that's fascinating to me about these kinds of events is you meet people here that you only meet here every year. And so you've got 12 months worth of catching up to do. And Nikki's one of those kinds of people. Nikki's a pilot, an enthusiastic pilot, and tell us about the endorsements, the rate. What's your path right now that you're on?
My current path is I'm currently working on my commercial rating. I just passed my written, so I'm waiting for my check ride for that. Then I'll go on to CFI, and I want to start just teaching people how to fly. That's what I want to do.
And why is that? Why is that attractive to you?
I enjoy teaching. I've actually spent years teaching archery, and I enjoy teaching in Civil Air Patrol. I teach cadets. So it's just a natural progression for me to go into aviation and teach people how to fly in aviation.
Now, if you're interested in becoming a CFI, how would you do that? Do you get associated with a particular flying school or do it as an independent? How would you do that?
Well, it really depends on the individual. You can do it both ways. You can purchase your own aircraft and hire a CFI to teach you. I went through an actual flight school or flight club. So I pay a small monthly fee to be part of a club. And then I have a pool of flight instructors. And I interviewed each of the flight instructors, picked one I really liked. He's here today at Sun and Fun, too. And then he and I just go flying all the time now. We'll go flying for breakfast. And that's how I got to know all of my flight instructors. And I picked one I liked. And he does all of my flight training until I hit CFI.
And then when you hit CFI, would you also stay associated with that club?
Most likely I will, because there are a lot of personal individuals. It's not a big flight school. My goal is not to fly for the airlines. I just want to become a CFI and teach, maybe become a double I, maybe, knock on wood.
Yeah. And so the aircraft you've been flying recently...
Recently, I've been flying a Cessna 172N. It's an older model 172, but we've upgraded all the avionics in it, so I pretty much have all glass instruments in my plane. I have a Garmin 530 in it, so I did all my instrument work on that. And on the back end of it, I'm actually currently working on, I volunteer at a museum. I'm also working on an S2 tracker. So that's one of my big things I love doing.
What's an S2 tracker?
An S2 tracker, at least ours, was originally, it was a sub hunter. It actually carried a torpedo to hunt down subs, and then I believe they did reconnaissance with it after the fact. But it's got big radial engines, and it's a really cool airplane.
And it probably doesn't have the armament that it had originally.
It still has its torpedo bay, and we have some of the old radios in it, but all of them were demilled. So the boxers are there, and a lot of times they'll drill a hole through the circuit boards. But we can still open the bomb bay to drop the torpedo, but there's nothing in there. But if you're sitting in the cockpit, the release is still there to open it, and it's kind of cool. But right now, we're working on the tail of the airplane. So I'm pulling apart the entire tail. So next weekend, I'm pulling off the elevators, and then we're going to pull off the rudders, and the plane's been sitting for 10 years. So we're going to pretty much rip the whole plane apart, make sure everything is flight-worthy, put it all back together again, and cross our fingers.
Is there documentation for assembly and disassembly and all that kind of thing? The specifications? Do you have the drawings?
We have all the books for it. So if you if you're an AMP, you open up the book and it tells you where every single nut and bolt is for the aircraft. So I am not an AMP, but I work with three of them while I'm working on the aircraft. So they tell me remove all these bolts, and I spend all day removing like one panel because all the bolts are rusted. And they've been sitting for over 10 years. So it's a very long and fun project.
And when it's completed, you've got something that you can be really proud of, something that you can look at and say, hey, you know, I did that.
Yes. In fact, one of the people I work with is the pilot that's going to fly it. So it's a lot of fun, and I can't wait till, I'm guessing, 2 years from now it might fly again.
Very good. We'll look forward to that. You think you'd would you fly it in? You live here in Florida, but would you fly it in?
I would fly, if they let me fly it in. You need a type rating because it's over 12,500 pounds. But by the time it's flight worthy, I should have I should have my multi-engine commercial rating for it. So if they allow me to get a type rating, I'll pay for it. And I would fly it in a heartbeat. It's probably 30 minutes from here by airplane. Yeah, yeah. It's probably 2 hours driving, but it's about, I would guess, 30 minutes. I believe the plane cruises at 250 knots.
Nice.
I think.
Very good. That's cool. Now, you've been to, I don't know how long you've been in Florida, but you've been to Sun and Fun at least once before, I know.
Yes, this is my fourth Sun and Fun, but this is the first time I've actually come as a participant. I almost always volunteer for Sun and Fun. I volunteered with Civil Air Patrol. I volunteered just as a individual for Sun and Fun. In fact, I even got a safety award from Sun and Fun for saving someone's life.
You did. I remember that.
Yes. So I was told when I got it, I was only the third person in Sun and Fun's history to ever get it. I've not been able to confirm or deny that yet. But it sits on my desk. It's a really nice award. You know, it has the date. I did the deed and everything.
That's impressive. And, of course, you just arrived shortly, so you haven't been around the campus much here today. But I imagine that attending as a regular attendee instead of as a volunteer is going to be kind of a different experience.
Well, yes. The first big thing is, you know, I had to pay to get in. That was the first. But it is, because as a volunteer, you're normally focusing on one major area. Or like yourself, you're walking around interviewing people. For me, I can go to all the different events. I can sit down at an event. I don't have a schedule I have to adhere to. This year, I'm actually looking to buy an airplane. So I'm actually looking at all the private aircraft, which I have never done as a volunteer because I'm normally where the people are.
Anything kind of specific in mind or type that you're interested in?
Currently, I'm looking at an air coupe because specifically they can be light sport depending on the make and model you buy, but also they don't have rudder pedals. I spent a lot of time teaching Paralympic archery, and when I become a CFI, I would like to teach people who are possibly paralyzed, who have not had the opportunity to fly, and since an air coupe does not have rudder pedals, it is a very easy aircraft to teach in.
Nikki, you're such a good person. That is an outstanding objective. That's probably a group of people that have difficulty flying, and if you can do something to make that easier for them, that's just wonderful.
Yes, and if you're part of Flying Magazine, there's actually been articles of other pilots who have been paralyzed from one reason or the other, and they explain how they had challenges at first becoming a pilot and how they overcame those. And that's kind of what inspired me to do this, especially with my background from archery. Yeah. And I thought it would be something fun to do. And I like air coupes. They're a cool little airplane.
Yeah. Is there something about being a proficient in archery and piloting that's related?
Well, it probably is. In archery, you have to always practice. You always have to be, you know, you want to shoot your bow at least 5 times a week. And in flying, you always want to be studying. You know, you never stop studying. You know, you can buy a magazine and just open it up. There's always an article about how to recover from a stall or how to do this or how to learn about something. Or even think about Sun and Fun. Sun and Fun, normally it's a normal airport, but it has a very specific approach procedure. So even if you weren't coming to Sun and Fun, you can open up the book and study how to do it. No, you're studying for the day. That's something you're learning. Aviation, you are always learning. You never know everything. Never.
Yes. Yeah. And almost any pilot will tell you that.
Right.
That it's a kind of a lifelong journey, and getting better and better and learning more and more. And that attracts a certain type of person, I think. Someone who's also likes to adhere to procedures and process, and you know, a loose cannon is not a good candidate for being a pilot, I guess. So, well, it's a little gray right now. Hopefully, the ceiling will lift a little bit, and we'll get some good air show performances in this afternoon. So, it's great to see you again, Nikki. Great to catch up with you. Hope you have a wonderful day at Sun Fun. Are you going to be here just Saturday? Today is Saturday as we record this. Or are you going to be here for the entire weekend, depending on the weather?
I will be here the entire weekend. Believe it or not, tomorrow my mother is coming. This will be her very first air show. So rain or shine, I will be here with her. Hopefully it'll be nice in the morning. She can see the airplanes. But she only lives an hour from here. So I'm excited to be here with her for her first air show.
Is she an airplane person?
No. I took her up one time on a small two-seater airplane.
Yeah.
And she was like, we did the pattern, and she said land, and she never got on the airplane ever again. So, yeah. No, she just likes the big airplanes. That's all she does.
Yeah. Well, she'll probably have a great time here. So, again, thanks, Nikki, for joining us. This has been Max Flight from the Airplane Geeks podcast, reporting for Sun and Fun Radio at Sun and Fun 21.
Also at the Sun and Fun Aerospace Expo, I had a chat with Sandy Sanderson about Project 404, the Ravens, a covert operation in Southeast Asia.
This is Max Flight from the Airplane Geeks podcast, but this week I'm on special assignment with Sun and Fun Radio, reporting from Sun and Fun 21. And I'm at the Air America display booth, tent, with Sandy Sanderson. He's retired from the Air Force. And we're going to talk a little bit about Air America and some of the interesting things that he's been involved in. Sandy, welcome to Sun and Fun Radio, first of all. But for those who may not know completely what the Air America operation was all about, can you give us just a really quick synopsis?
Well, Air America, they were the professionals over there. They did anything, anywhere, anytime, more or less their motto, and very professional about it. The outfit I was in, we got involved in the war. We were actually military. We weren't allowed to be in Laos. So when we crossed the border from Thailand, we left our uniforms in the Connex, never to be seen again, and put on civilian clothes, turned in our U.S. Air Force identification badge, and left the country of Thailand with a driver's license and an embassy card for Laos, crossed the border, and then started doing our thing. We were not really Air America. There was a bunch of confusion at the time as to what Air America did, and we got glommed right in the middle of it. All the things that we did, Air America got blamed for. So,
we being the CIA.
No, meaning the Ravens.
The Ravens, that's right.
Project 404, which was the overall umbrella. A little bit of background. In Vietnam, you had 500,000 troops. Army, Air Force, Navy, Marines, and some allied forces. And you had all the trappings involved in a major war with news media embedded with them and Walter Cronkite reporting on bomb damage assessments for the day and how many bombs were dropped. And there was always that stiff competition between the Air Force and the Navy. And meanwhile, the grunts down in the field actually working, they were probably only about 20,000 who actually were conducting the war. The rest of that 480,000 was support. And you could consider the Air Force, the entire Air Force, was support because we supported them with fighter bombers and forward air controllers and so forth. The rules were rather extensive in South Vietnam for the forward air controllers. But those of us who ended up going over into Laos, the rules were very simple. There aren't any rules. We didn't have to... we did things that were kind of abhorrent to the regular military in that military normally has a chain of command. And someplace in there, every member in the armed services is in that chain someplace. Well, in this case, we were spit out the side. The Air Force continued to pay my salary. They also continued to administer my records. But for all intents and purposes, that was it. I was gone from the Air Force and over in the country of Laos. And we were under the control of the State Department. And to the military, State Department and the military department's defense, you just never saw eye to eye very often. And so for me to go over there was kind of like a kiss of death for that. But like I say, we worked with Air America very closely. And because of the misconceptions in Vietnam as they're conducting their war about what was going across the fence and that other secret war that was going on, that was just as intense, more brutal than in Vietnam, but there, we relied upon the indigenous people to conduct the war, with the exception of a couple of us, Ravens. Forward air controllers, all we did was go out, spot targets, bring in the fighters, conduct an airstrike, and collect bomb damage assessment, report it uphill, and continue on our daily business.
What kinds of people became the Ravens?
The Ravens had to be from Vietnam and had to be finished part of their one-year tour in Southeast Asia, and then were selected to go over there. Now, there's two ways of selecting. It was classified at the time, highly classified, and we had to volunteer to go there, and there was the catch-22. You weren't allowed to know about it, but you had to volunteer to go there. And then when you volunteered, they either did an investigation of you or they wholeheartedly agreed and got rid of us, got us out of Vietnam, because we were the guys who were at the ragged edge of the rules of engagements. We would go ahead and, I wouldn't say disobey them as much as interpret them in a different way than was written in plain language. We found ways around of a lot of things. And when we got identified as that type of a person, that's exactly what they wanted over in Laos. And so we were volunteered, or we actually volunteered ourselves to go over there. The types of people that we gravitated toward were, like I say, the young kids who got dissatisfied with what was going on, how the war was conducted. It was very political in Vietnam. I'll give you an example. Targeting. Now, the targeting list started with the president, went through his staff, and they added targets based on 36-hour-old intelligence. And you're talking about crossing the international timeline from Washington, D.C. to Southeast Asia. And so it would go through the staff, go through the Department of Defense, go through the Joint Chiefs of Staff, through the Departments of Army, Air Force, Navy, Marines, get on down into Hickam, Hawaii, where they would go ahead and add targets at the 17th and 12th Air Force area. Then we go to Saigon. They would add targets. Then it get down to individual, like the 101st and 82nd Airborne Division, and they had targets they wanted to go ahead and hit with, you know, heavy artillery, as they used to call the fighter bombers. And then they would go ahead and take this list, divide it amongst the 10 fighting outfits, fighter bomber units in Southeast Asia, in Thailand, and in Vietnam. And they would go ahead and divide up the piece of the pie, and that's where the term frag came from. You fragment the air order of battle of the day. Now, you go ahead and target a certain specific target with fighter bombers, and they're flying along at 480 knots at 22, 27, 30,000 feet, and they're given a set of coordinates. And to them, flying at that speed and that quick and only have enough juice or fuel left to go ahead and get to the destination, loiter for 5 minutes and have to go home because they're out of gas, they'll just look around the sky and point to it and say, well, that looks about right, and they could be 10 miles off. So to avoid that issue, they had forward air controllers who were taught how to read maps and how to adjust artillery and how to direct airstrikes and move them closer and closer to the optimum target area, and had techniques to go ahead and do that. And we showed up at every one of those targets where the fighter bombers were going to go and drop, except in North Vietnam. And then we went ahead and found the target for them. If the target had moved, like a truck, truck identified 36 hours before, just is not going to be at this coordinate that was identified before by national resource assets, reconnaissance, and so forth. So we go hand around for him. Another part of the rule said you had to orbit that target if he had moved the target. Well, now you got the Vietnamese on the ground looking up and seeing a forward air controller orbit his position. He's saying, uh-oh, you know, looks like I'm going to be the guy. And so the other rules of engagements were, for instance, also started just like the targeting list from the president and worked its way on down into the individual units through the staff and big headquarters in Hickam, Hawaii, and Saigon, and so forth. And give an example of a threat of rules of engagements that we found kind of ludicrous. Trucks. We couldn't hit trucks in Haiphong Harbor because we may have collateral damage with a French freighter right next door unloading something. Normally it's war goods, but, you know, it's a friendly country. And if you accidentally drop a bomb on that freighter, you know, international incident. So to avoid collateral damage, you can't hit them in Haiphong Harbor. Best place to get it. You know, armaments is right there when it's being offloaded. And then the State Department says you can't hit a truck in a major trail or road route structure in North Vietnam because you may injure civilian truck drivers. And we've heard that before. And then you go to another department, says Commerce, says you can't hit a truck within 5 miles of the border of North Vietnam and Laos because you may interfere with commerce, irrespective of the fact that there is no village or town or city of any sizable amount to conduct commerce along this structure wherever it ends. You couldn't do it. And then Air Force said, well, you can't hit a truck northbound because northbound assumption is empty. Southbound, that's what you want to get. You don't want to waste your assets on an empty truck. And so it went on like this. And then Saigon says, if you are based in South Vietnam, you can't hit a truck on the Laotian border, across the border. If you're based in Thailand, you cannot hit a truck on the Vietnamese side of the border. You got to go ahead and keep your offhand. So, okay, this guy's on this truck, driving around, just happy as can be, looks up, sees somebody orbiting him. Uh-oh. He turns around, starts heading north. Can't hit him anymore. He goes.
And does he know that?
Yeah, oh, he knows all the rules.
He knows the rules as well.
Yeah, he's got copies of them, you know. So, and they change daily, virtually. And in Vietnam, I only stayed there around 5 months, but I had to take a test as a forward air controller, a 100-question test every month for each military region I flew in. And I was studying that darn test because if I failed the test, got below 85%, I was grounded, could only fly with an instructor until I retook the test to, correct it up above 85. And the test changed every month, and they added and subtracted rules, and it was a floating document, and you had to know everything in there. Because the forward air controllers were the keeper of the keys. And like I say, the manuals were all 2 to 3 inches thick for each military region. In Laos, you had a half sheet of paper, double-spaced, typewritten on one side only, how to get around the rules of engagements. And the biggest way to do it was our backseaters that went with us in most of our flights were Laotians. Infantry officers is their country, and between the two of us, we decided where to drop a bomb. Normally, when I took off, if the target moved, I had to go ahead and do what was called a validation request. In a validation request, you go up, contact an airborne command control ship up in the sky, C-130, sitting there orbiting with 17, 18 guys in the back monitoring radios, and you go ahead and say, I got a validation request, and the validation essentially is you revalidate that target you were assigned because it had moved. And you give the coordinates encrypted and the type of weapons you wanted because the target may have gotten a different priority, and the type of fusing you wanted and how much play time you had available to orbit the area. And it would send it up to headquarters or go to an intelligence facility. They would analyze it, come back and give the approval or disapproval, send it back up to airborne command control ship. Then he would coordinate with the tanker where the fighters were sitting waiting for their target assignment or had a target assignment waiting for the time period to get there. And then go to our rendezvous point. And that whole process took 45 minutes. I'm orbiting in circles for 45 minutes while this guy finally figures it out and moves.
And what kind of an aircraft are you flying?
In Vietnam, we had OV-10s, Broncos, and we had Cessna Skymasters. That was in the 72 time frame. Earlier than that, there were also 01 Bird Dogs. In Laos, we had 01 Bird Dogs, and the Ambassador's U-17, which was a much higher speed and longer range tail dragger. And we had, in some areas, we had T-28s that we could use with rockets only. We weren't allowed to drop bombs from them. That was kind of forbidden. And so we would be flying along, for instance, and our interaction with Air America would be something like this. This guy would, they always monitored our frequency, Air America did. Because if we got in trouble and said something unusual or told the flight lead control I got to go home because the ambassador rule was we were supposed to always be for any bomb dropping in Laos, we had to be present. And if I'm going home right away, it meant something's wrong with my airplane, and I'd have a helicourier and a helicopter right in my wing within a minute to assist me in case I ended up, crashing the airplane. And which was quite often. Over the course of 7 years that we were doing this job in Laos, we had about 160 of us who flew the call sign Ravens in that course, in that period of time. Any one time, in 5 different villages we lived in, there were between 7 and maybe 20 forward air controllers, Raven facts. And we just completed the rest of our tour. So getting back to the original part of the story about the Air Americas. It would come up on our frequency. They say, hey, Raven, this is Alpha Golf. I say, okay, Alpha Golf, what can I do for you? He said, I got to drop some supplies off on Lima Site 33. And that was how they coded the airports, different numbers. I'm just giving you a fictitious airport. And I said, okay, well, what do you need? He says, well, there's a firefight going on right now. Can you come over? Said, okay, be right there. I go over to Lima Site 33. As soon as the Raven shows up, most of the hostilities would cease. They didn't want to go and get targeted, so they backed off and hid. If I had a set of fighters coming in, okay, I'd just throw a rocket down in the vicinity of where we knew they were located, and as soon as the smoke rocket goes off, if they weren't the immediate target, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Minh would go ahead and Viet Cong would go ahead and climb the trees to watch the airstrike, because it's a twofer. Aerobatics, because you see this fighter rolling in, going upside down, taking a dive bomb angle, coming off in white wings as he pulls off back up in the sky again. The bombs come off, and it's fireworks. Everybody likes fireworks.
Sure.
And so the guy's watching aerobatics and combination fireworks, and it's a twofer. And I tell number two, you got me in sight, Raj. Mark, drop your bomb right here. I fly right over the top, off in the distance, and see who's up in the trees. And, you know, I call it monkey busting missions to take the monkeys out of the trees. And meanwhile, the Alpha Golf helicopter would go on in to the site, drop its ammunition or malaria pills or boots or food supplies or whatever they were supplying, and get out of there, all without any bullets whizzing around over his head. So that was the interaction we had with Air America for the most part. When we got shot down, they were ready on the spot, or logistically, we could support them.
All right, well, Sandy, we could talk forever, but there's a whole crew of people here who I'm holding up who are waiting to listen to you to tell some of these stories and some others as well. I want to thank all of you folks who came to see Sandy for being patient. I appreciate it. Do you want to be on the radio? You can be on the radio station. Let's just have a shout-out for Sun and Fun. Everybody yell, Sun and Fun. Let's have it. One, two, three.
Sun and Fun.
You're on the radio. All right, this has been Max Flight from the Airplane Geeks podcast reporting for Sun and Fun Radio at Sun and Fun 21.
Launchpad spoke with Hank Coates, the CEO and president of the Commemorative Air Force, and also Nancy McGee, vice president of education, about their new headquarters and the Henry B. Tippie National Aviation Education Center.
Hey, Airplane Geeks, it's your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, and we've flown up, okay, in all honesty, we drove. It's IMC, and it's raining like heck, so it's been 3 hours. But still, it was worth the drive, because I'm at a really great location, which we're going to talk about, and I'm here with some really special people. I'm here with
Hank Coates, CEO and president of the CAF.
And sitting next to him is
Nancy McGee. I'm the vice president of education.
Full disclosure, listeners, your reporter at large here is a CAF member, and I'm a member of the B-29 squadron, which flies Fifi, as you all know. But I am here purely for your enjoyment right now to get you caught up on what we're doing. And we're in a really cool campus. We're in the, if you will, headquarters for the CAF. Hank, tell us about this campus and what's all here.
Sure. The CAF's national headquarters moved from Midland here a few years ago. And at the national headquarters, you have the headquarters entity, which houses all of the people and building and offices for the things that go on at the national level. And then we have the restoration hangar, which is a large hangar that has room and tooling in there to work on aircraft. And then we have the Henry B. Tippie National Aviation Education Center, which is an incredible new facility, and I'll let Nancy tell you more about that.
Yeah, that's it. We're here in the Henry B. Tippin facility. Nancy, tell us about this cool place.
Well, this is a 40,000-square-foot facility, complete with a working hangar that will fit both of our B-29, our B-24, and other aircraft. We have a museum side to this that's about 6,100 square feet, where we'll tell a number of different stories about World War II history and those who served. And then we have an education side of the building where it's really about hands-on 21st century learning.
And listeners, I realize this is radio, so let me tell you, we're here in the lobby, which is also going to be part of their galleries. There's a full-size B-51 mock-up hanging above our heads with the nose art for Katie, and that's pretty impressive. Let me go back to Hank real quick. Who's the facility named for?
The facility's named for Henry B. Tippy. He was a World War II veteran from Iowa. He was a farm boy that his mom, I think the words were, she said, Henry, if you want a life, you've got to move out of Iowa, get off the farm. And he joined the Army Air Corps in World War II, and as an enlisted man was deployed to the Pacific. At the culmination of World War II, he came back home using the Montgomery GI Bill or the GI Bill. He got his college degree in I think it was accounting and business, and entered in the business world and did very, very, very well. And he contributed a significant amount and has been a long-term CAF member of the B-29, B-24 squadron. He loves education. He loves the CAF. And he provided a big part of the funding for this building and this facility.
Well, and this is a pretty huge facility. Where else did your fundings come from? Was there any federal money?
That's a great question. No, there was no federal funding. The funding for this building, we raised right around $14 million, which will pay for the entire building and the first years of operating costs. Most of the money came from foundational support inside of Texas and outside nationwide. Some of the money came from a business development matching deal from the city of Dallas. Mr. Tippy obviously provided some of that. And then about, I think it was $400,000 was raised directly from CAF member contributions, $10 at a time, $20 at a time, $1,000 at a time. But what I can tell you is that none of the funds came from the foundation, from membership fees, from ANUAC or any of that. And there will be no long-term debt once this thing's completely finished. It's 95% done. We have some punch lists that are going through with the contractor. We do have the certificate of occupancy, and we are starting to do some small events. But, yeah, there's no long-term debt, which is critically important to the membership of the CAF.
That's cool. I mean, that's really neat. Let's real quick give us an overview of what is the CAF and how is it organized?
So the CAF and it's been around for a very long time, and it's very, very sustainable. In general, the national headquarters exists, and a lot of the things that need to be done outside of the units, negotiations for insurance, a lot of the marketing, regulatory issues, safety and training programs, fundraising from the larger perspective is done at the national headquarters. The units are arranged loosely franchises. And so you have the very large units, Air Base Georgia and Air Base Arizona, all the way down to some of your more smaller units and sponsor groups, which may have 10 or 12 members in them. And so the aircraft are all owned by the Flying Museum. They're assigned to the units by the Flying Museum.
Now, the Flying Museum is a subpart of the CAF, correct?
Right. There are basically four boards of directors within the CAF. You have the CAF General Staff, which is the overarching board of directors. You have the Foundation Board, which is they manage the foundation funds for the CAF. They manage loans and things that we may need to do with units and things. And that's where our nest egg is kept. Then there is the Museum Board. The Museum Board is the entity which governs the NAEC and everything associated with that and the museum assets. They also answer to the General Staff, as does the Foundation Board. And then the last board is the Flying Museum Board. And all of the aircraft assets fall under the Flying Museum. And the Flying Museum Board, they assign the aircraft to the units. They make sure that the units are treating the aircraft appropriately. They can provide some funding for restoration and for other things to the units. So that unit also answers to the CAF board.
Roughly how many aircraft are we talking about?
There's over 170 aircraft in the CAF. It's a number that slowly but steadily is climbing, and we're looking at acquiring a couple aircraft in the next few months.
Well, that makes the CAF roughly bigger than some, you know, Banana Republic Air Forces.
That's kind of funny. So we are the world's largest flying museum, bar none. And last time I looked, I think we ranked like number 23rd in the world in Air Force size. So yeah, you're right.
Okay, well listeners, let me lay it out for you. We've got a headquarters building, which is a really nice facility of itself. Next to it is what we would call the transit hangar, which has just been redone, and it's really nice. It's insulated. It's got a new floor on it. And then across the way is the maintenance hangar, which is the old police hangar here. And that's where, you know, real metal banging will go on. But between these two is this huge, big facility. Nancy, tell me more about this great facility.
Well, this great facility has a museum component to it, so it'll be open to the public. Our grand opening, November 11th. So that will be an opportunity for people to come in and see our artifacts. The CAF has the world's largest collection, single largest collection of World War II nose art. So some of those pieces will be on display in the gallery, as well as other artifacts. We have the Brigadier General Charles McGee and Don Hines Theater, where we will show the Rise Above WASP, which is the Women Air Force Service pilot film, and another one about the Red Tail Tuskegee Airmen. And we're going to tell five stories in our museum. We're going to talk about the Aztec Eagles, Mexican-American squadron. We're going to talk about Rosie the Riveter, who helped build all these aircraft, Women Air Force Service pilots, and the North Texas involvement in World War II efforts.
This isn't just a static museum, because the CAF will host here the P-51 from the Tuskegee Airmen and a T-6 from the WASPs.
Absolutely. We get a chance to see real living history. As Hank said, we're a flying museum. We are the largest flying museum. So besides just the displays that we have, we never know what aircraft is going to be in the hangar. And that, too, will be part of the museum experience that people will get to see.
Well, how many squadrons are actually going to be co-located or call this building home?
So there's six or seven units that call this place home. You got the B-29, B-24 squadron, Ike's Bird sponsor group, the Red Tail group, the T-6 WASP, the L-2. So it's quite a few people that call this place home. It's not just for one entity, and it's not just one mission. It's a great place, and it does all sorts of fun stuff. And you know, I'll add something that Nancy just talked about, and you did too. You know, when you go to a museum and you see these airplanes inside and it's kind of antiseptic, those just – they're kind of not airplanes anymore. An airplane's an airplane when it smells like an airplane. It feels like an airplane, and it's out there flying. That's an airplane.
Dripping oil.
Yeah, it's just a display. If it's not flying, it might as well be that plastic P-51 hanging from the roof. You know, our airplanes have character. They have lives of their own. They're kind of like – you know, they have their unique behaviors even. So our airplanes fly, and we fly them safely, and we work very, very hard to make sure we do it right.
All right, we've just walked into this room, and there's like eight science tables laid out and a part of a wing. What are we doing in here?
Well, this is called the Build Guild, and this is an area where we can do woodworking and metalworking, and you've got to start someplace. You know, we've had students in this room that think that a screwdriver is either a plus or a minus, not a flathead or a Phillips. So we have to start them someplace and have programs that vertically align all the way up to industry certification so that they can go straight into the workforce and be productive members of society.
like I said, we've got workbenches here. We're banging on metal and bending things and gluing things together.
They who do the work do the learning. So it's all about putting your hands on things and learning how to do it. We're building pedal planes. We have high school juniors who have never operated power tools that are building pedal planes for us for a fourth grade program. We also have the J3 Cub that is from 1946, and we have high school students who have dismantled that, and they're restoring it to flight status, where we'll then use it for students to build flight hours. So it's all about getting kids involved, and these are kids that haven't had any background in this.
And, guys, this is a large lab. It holds, just by seating, I can see 64 places at the benches.
Exactly, but it's not just for kids. You know, kids, we're kids of all ages with more or less body hair, depending on the phase in life. So, you know, we can have week-long conferences where we bring in some aviation expert, somebody who it's anything from engine repair to fabric doping. So CAF members will get to come in here and get to learn some new skills, but it's also about building programs that we take out to our many CAF units, because so many of those units are doing their own education operations. So we're the incubator for programs that they have.
All right, and let's go across the hall. Oh, stop. The hallway is super cool, guys. The hallway is a runway, 0422 with a displaced threshold, taxi markings. Oh, this is just a too cool. But we go across, and now we're in, it looks like a radio lab.
Well, it does look a little bit like a radio lab, and everything in here is designed to be flexible space. But our bread and butter everyday program 5 days a week in this room that we call the home front is a simulation about being in World War II in the home front. So, you know, when you think about today's time, unless you're a military family, you're relatively unaffected by what's happening in any conflicts around the world. But during World War II, everybody was involved, even in the home front. An 8-year-old boy, 5-year-old girl, they were all involved in it. So this home front simulation assigns everybody a role, and they take place and they interact in it, but it meets the needs of schools where it's a standards-driven instruction, it's content-integrated, and it's really interactive. So kids love it, but they're learning. They're learning history, they're learning financial literacy, they're learning math, science, and of course, it's deeply embedded with history.
And this isn't just you deciding to do this. This is in coordination with, like, I don't know, the Texas Board of Education or the Dallas school system?
Well, we have a number of educators like myself that understand standards-based instruction and the needs of schools, but we are also a Texas Education Agency certified professional development provider. So we'll do teacher professional development here as well as programs for kids.
Got it. All right. Let's step out of here. And we're in this, as a guy who owns an airplane, absolutely stunningly beautiful hangar. The floor is a sealed white. It's huge. It's big enough to hold a B-29, a B-24, and a B-17 all at the same time. Give you an idea of size. People will be able to, when the airplanes are here and not out on tour, they'll be able to walk around and look at them, correct?
Absolutely. You can look at them. You can smell them. Some of them you'll be able to touch. We hope to have a few that you can get inside. So, yeah, it's a really interactive thing. You get to see it. As CAF always says, you get to drop the ropes on the aircraft. So we're not museum displays.
This facility is, of course, brand spanking new. You just said your opening will be in November. And now we're in, what room is this?
Well, we're currently in the room called the Think Tank, which is designed to be a 21st century conference room. So it's really not a conference room with death by PowerPoint. This is all about innovation. You get to write on the glass. We've got an interactive, like a giant iPad on the wall. So we get people in here to really think through problems. You know, a lot of people ask me, how long will these World War II aircraft fly? And my answer is, as long as we can educate people to be critical thinkers, problem solvers, and innovators.
But you're not just shooting for middle school and high school students, right? Corporations can use this for events.
Corporations can use this for events. We have a number of programs where corporations can do team building, like that Homefront simulation. We have an adult version of that. That's a lot of fun. So, yeah, this is all rentable facility, but a lot of program-based as well. We have a four-year-old program where they can come in and get inspired by aviation. We'll be doing things like a bicycle fix-a-thon for the neighborhood. Our displays will change, not like a museum does, but by the fact that we have reenactors here or a different aircraft has flown in. So there's going to be something new every day for people to see at the CAAF National Air Base.
Nancy?
Well, where on the big map are we?
We are in Dallas, Texas, at the Dallas Executive Airport, which is about a 20-minute drive south of downtown Dallas.
Okay, which means we could, from Love Field, which would mean we'd only be 15 minutes if we were having to ride in those human aluminum mailing tubes, or as opposed to if we flew ourselves, we could just fly directly in here.
Yeah.
Nancy, if they want to know more about the education program, where would they go?
Go to the CAF website, which is commemorativeairforce.org, or flynaec.org.
And that would be the same address for the regular CAF if they want to join. If they want to join their local unit or find out where their local unit's at, where would they go?
That would be commemorativeairforce.org. There's a specific page there where you can see the location of every unit in the United States. And there's actually something we're working on right now is a new unit initiative where we're working really hard with four or five different new entities to put some new CAF units out there. So you're going to start learning more and more about that if you go to that website and how you could bring a CAF unit to the location where you are.
Well, now there's information you can use. And this is just a cool facility, listeners. We'll try and put some photos in the show notes. But for now, this is your reporter at large, Launchpad Mazzari, frequency change approved. Good day.
Another interview from Sun and Fun, this time with Major Danny Gill, United States Air Force 82nd Aerial Targets Squadron, on the modified Dash 8 used to support live fire weapons deployment.
This is Max Flight from the Airplane Geeks podcast. This week I'm on special assignment with Sun and Fun Radio, reporting from Sun and Fun 21. I'm here with Major Danny Gill, 82nd ATRS. And you came in what looked like, from a distance, a Dash 8 aircraft, but this is a little bit modified from that. What's the mission of this aircraft?
All right, so this aircraft is a Dash 8, so from afar it looks like a regular Dash 8, but as you get closer, as you can see, it's modified, and the purpose it's modified for is to support live fire weapons employment and evaluation and training over the Gulf Range up in the northern Gulf of Mexico near the panhandle of Florida. So,
and how has it been modified from its standard configuration?
So it has a sea surveillance radar that hanging from the bottom of it. And then on the right side of the fuselage, there's a telemetry antenna. It's a passive antenna. It just gathers telemetry information off the missiles that are being shot over the range. And then the sea surveillance radar is meant to find boats that are out in the water for safety purposes.
So you can chase them away from the active area.
I know, sir. We don't chase any boats. We just figure out where they are. Okay. And then from that, you know, they're allowed to be there. But based on where they are, we move around them. So we determine what that picture is. And then the safety office with all the shoot parameters and all the information they have on what, you know, ultimately we're trying to accomplish with our training and evaluation that day, they determine where we're going to shoot based on where those boats are.
All right, so maybe describe a typical mission, kind of from start to finish, sort of an overview.
So typical mission, we're there, again, to support the live fire shoots. So we'll take off about an hour prior to when the shoots are supposed to happen. From that, we also are launching targets, so unmanned aerial targets out over the range that it's a target. Right. So the fighters are out there with their missiles, employing their missiles and whatever tactics they're looking to do, evaluate, train on, test, what have you. So we go out there about an hour prior, sweep the range, determine where those boats are, and then from that they determine what picture they have and where they want to shoot from. So after that, we'll set up a hold. We'll stay on station and make sure that there's no other boats moving around. We'll keep track of boats of interest that may possibly interfere with the chute. And then we'll also set up to gather that telemetry data off the missiles being shot.
So this drone here, this VQM-167, this is an example of a target drone?
Yes, this is the drone, the target that we used most often. It's a VQM-167. It launches off a rail with a big jet, with a rocket engine, and then it picks up its own propulsion under an onboard jet engine.
Okay. Who manufactures this?
Not sure, off the top of my head. Right. But it's known as a BQM-167. And so
it's expendable.
It is an expendable target. That is correct.
And are there other kinds of targets that could come to play here?
Sure. And out of our squadron, we also fly what's known as a QF-16. We have some of those here parked here. We brought two of them with us. But 99% of the time, if not more, those are being flown manned. But they're also modified to fly unmanned as well. So they can fly, take off under radio control, and operated from the same control room that we fly these drones.
And some people, when they hear about this, the fact that F-16s can be used as target drones, sometimes people think, well, that must be crazy. Why would we want to shoot down our own F-16s? But these are older models that are not otherwise active, right?
That's correct. They come to us with still a small amount of flight time, and we fly those out because there's still a mission that we do manned to support target operations. But ultimately, they do end up getting shot. So, yeah.
And is the orange tail the typical indicator that that's what this is?
That's correct, yeah. So, the paint scheme that you see has just been used for our drones here. So this subscale drone is also orange. It's just what we use. So depending on what they're shooting, they want to get a visual acquisition of that target. So it's just nicer to see a big orange target in the air as opposed to something more subdued and difficult to see.
Well, how about your background? How long have you been serving in the military?
So I've been in the Air Force for about 15 years.
You don't look old enough to be in there 15 years. You're in pretty good shape.
I try to take care of my skin and myself, and you know.
It works.
Yeah, yes, sir. I appreciate that. So I've been in the Air Force for about 15 years. Started my career off as a navigator on C-130s, moved to special operations, eventually became a pilot, and here I am now flying the E-9. So it's a very unique outfit, real small operation, but very vital to the mission of fighter aircraft and their training, their evaluations of weapons and employment and all that stuff.
For someone who's maybe younger and is thinking about a career in the military or in the Air Force, what can you say about the degree to which you can plan your course or chart your course through the training and through the assignments and so forth? How does that work?
So ultimately, everything from, you know, when I, so I entered via, I was a military brat, so my mom was in the Air Force. And ever since, you know, at things like this, air shows like this, is where I decided I want to be a pilot. So I ultimately, I went to college. I did the ROTC program. That's where I got my commission from, right here down the road at University of Central Florida. I studied engineering there, and pretty much everything from there is a meritocracy. It depends on, you know, how well you do. They rack and stack you, and it's very doable. I'm also pretty blessed physically. I got good vision and don't have any medical issues that prevent me from flying. I know lots of people that are completely capable of it, but they just run into those, you know, they don't have the good vision, or they have a medical issue that precludes them from flying. So fortunately, I am blessed to have that ability to go fly. But then from there, it's just like you hear all the time, everyone tells you, get good grades, study hard, and do well. That's what it boils down to at the end of the day. And it's a true meritocracy, along with, you know, needs of the Air Force. But it's definitely doable. And to answer your question, the path that way to get there is very clear. Although my pathway to become a pilot was a lot different, I still made it there. The opportunities are there. So
if you have the drive, the ambition, and the talents, and the attitude, and the hard work, the work ethic, and all of that.
Sure, yeah, all those things, you can control all those things. All those things you can control. just depends on how much work you want to put in and how bad you want to try to do it. So
that's great advice. Very, very good advice. Now, I have to ask, though, if it's not too personal, what did your mother do in the Air Force?
I don't know if she would want me telling you that, but I didn't find my way into much trouble. I'll just tell you that. So
okay. All right. All right. Well, appreciate it. Thanks, appreciate you, sir. Thanks for coming to the show and thanks for your service. We really appreciate it. It's just really amazing. I've always been in awe of people in the military that have such a clear sense of purpose and a drive. It's just it just amazes me. It's always amazed me. So, Major Danny Gill, thank you so much. This has been Max Flight from the Airplane Geeks podcast, reporting for Sun and Fun Radio at Sun and Fun 21.
I also ran across something unexpected at Sun and Fun, the Flying Musicians Association. Dennis Klotz and Trent McMillan were there representing the association.
This is Max Flight from the Airplane Geeks podcast. This week I'm on special assignment for Sun and Fun Radio, reporting from Sun and Fun 21. And I have just found I don't know what you call this. It's a tent. It's a tarp.
Yeah,
it's a
kind of a pavilion.
It's a pavilion. It's the Flying Musicians Association. And
they're sponsored by the LSA organization, yeah.
Sponsored by the LSA organization. And I'm here with Dennis Klotz and Trent McMillan. And they're here with their guitars and playing. And I wasn't aware of this organization, the Flying Musicians Association. It's a nonprofit.
Right. It is a nonprofit organization, and the primary goal is to encourage musicians and pilots to fellowship and networking and things like that. It started off as an idea from a gentleman by the name of John Zapp, and John recognized John and another guy, and I haven't met him. John and recognized early on that there was a similarity between the skill set needed to be a pilot, good pilot, and to be a good musician. And it's perseverance, it's the willingness to practice, it's the willingness to constantly train in the skills that you're trying to acquire, and learn new skills and learn new things.
And you've been playing for a long time. You've been a pilot for a long time also?
No, I'm a fairly new pilot. I got my certificate when I was 62 years old.
Great.
63, actually. I soloed at 62 and got my certificate at 63. But yeah, I started playing guitar when I was 13, so that was back in 1963.
Yeah, amazing. I have a dim memory of the 60s. It's not very strong, I'll tell you.
I was in the typical garage band, and we were doing pretty well. We were moving up the food chain, and it was during the Vietnam War, and I was drafted, went in the Navy for 6 years, and when I came out, I really wasn't active as a musician. Didn't actually start singing and playing until I was 50.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, I played, but I continued to play, but I never really... The only people I sang for was my family.
Yeah. Yeah, and did they appreciate that or not?
Oh yeah, actually, okay. They enjoyed the music. But a friend started an open mic night, and I started going to it. And he had to teach me everything. I had to learn how to keep my mouth near the microphone, and to finish a song that you start and go play all the way through. I was just telling him that it's interesting. You can practice, you can learn a song and you can practice it, until you actually perform in front of people, you don't really know the song.
And Trent, how about you? What's your aviation background to this point?
Okay, so right now I'm a senior at the Central Florida Aerospace Academy. That's the academy right here at the Lakeland Airport. And I am currently taking flight lessons off of the Bartow Airport, Bartow Executive Airport, and I have around 30 hours of flight training. And just about 3 weeks ago, I did my solo flight.
Oh, congratulations. Very good. Very good. And how did you come to find the Flying Musicians Association?
Yeah, so I was just walking around Sun and Fun, and my friend and I were just walking around, and I saw these guys. They had their guitars out, and of course, I'm attracted to the music side of everything, and I think it's great that they're having an outlet for all musical talented pilots.
Yes. Now, Andrew, you have a shirt on, Unmanned Squadron. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so that's the drone club here at school that I'm a part of. We fix drones, build drones, and fly them. But, of course, it's really tough to cut through the red tape here because we're flying at an airport. So it's really a special thing to have here. I believe that we're one of the only clubs here, especially at a school that is allowed to fly at an airport, which is very special. Yeah.
So last night for the evening air show, the nighttime air show, we were supposed to have a drone demonstration, but I guess that didn't happen. I'm not sure what the issue was. I don't know if you've heard anything about that.
I haven't heard anything about that, and I wasn't able to come. I wish I was. But what could have probably happened was poor weather conditions could be possible, too windy for the drones to be sent up, yeah.
So after school, what do you think is next in line for you?
Yeah, so after school, I'm going to hopefully attend the Emory Riddle College and hopefully pursue a career in either aerospace engineering or mechanical engineering.
Excellent. So how do you find the school here? I know we're getting a little off top. We'll come back to the flying musicians, but in terms of the school here, are you enjoying it? Is the instruction great, the students and all?
Yeah, the school is great. They have a lot of opportunity here in the aviation industry and a lot of engineering courses. And yeah.
Terrific. And so back to Dennis, does the... the association offers some benefits to pilots?
Well, the biggest benefit, obviously, is the companionship, the getting to know people. I've had opportunities as a result of being in the Flying Musicians. We perform, this is all volunteer performances. What we use the money that is collected and donated for is we have a solo program. They call it the Flying Musician Solo Program, where we reach out to high school music teachers to nominate kids in their classes that are musically oriented and at the same time are interested in flying. And each year we select one or two, three, depending on the money, students and provide them with the funds to pursue getting a certificate, flight certificate. And there have been a number that have already gone all the way through.
Yeah, that's terrific.
The other thing I was going to add, my opportunity has been that we do get to perform for some of the shows. And it was 2 years ago I was up at Oshkosh and got to perform at the Team Aeroshell dinner and got to... meet some of the pilots and hang out with them, and that's an opportunity that you can't pass it up.
Sure. That's been. You think you'll be back at Oshkosh?
I don't think so. It was a long trip for me. I'm from South Carolina, but it was a once in a lifetime deal. And normally I come down here to Sun and Fun, but 2 years ago my granddaughter was being born, and on the date that it was that the air show was here, so. I wasn't going to be allowed to break free from that and come down here.
Yeah, good choice, I think. I think that was the right decision.
I've been married long enough, I know what to do.
That's right. So what kind of airplane are you flying these days?
I have a Cherokee 180, 1970 Cherokee 180.
And have you had that for long?
I got it about 4 years, 5 years ago, something like that. Yeah. I'm a retired mechanical engineer. I started working on vehicles, everything from motorcycles to cars to trucks during my teen years, and so they allow me to assist with the maintenance and what have you. They watch me at the airport that I'm at, and they actually encourage owner-assisted work if you've got the skill.
Yeah.
They can spot the skill.
Was the plane in pretty decent shape when you picked it up?
Actually, it was the original owner. Well, one of the I don't know who the original owners were. It's bounced around a little bit, but the gentleman owned the airport a few years ago. His name is Buster Boshier, and Buster was an ex Air Force pilot. Buster owned that plane at one time, so And then also the guy that I take instrument lessons from, he owned the plane at for a period of time. So it's had very decent. It's old, so there are things that need to be taken care of. But I've made some improvements, and I've actually written several articles for Plane and Pilot magazine based on the work I've done on the plane.
Fantastic. All right. Well, this has been very exciting. For people that want to contribute to the Flying Musicians Association, make donations. I always, just sort of as an aside, usually I make charitable contributions at the end of the year. Right. Typically, that's when I do it. And for many years now, I've looked for aviation-related nonprofit organizations, charitable places that I can make donations to. And this is definitely one to add to my list. So the webs
go to the Flying Musicians Association. Just do a website search. They have a website.
Yeah, I think the website is flyingmusicians.org.
Yep, that'll work.
And that'll work. And then people can make a donation if they wish there. So you want to send us out with a little tune?
Yeah. Well, we'll do. But you can do part of the. Old Glen Campbell song. It's knowing that your door is always open and your path is free to walk. That makes me tend to leave my sleeping bag or the pan stash behind your couch. And it's knowing I'm not shackled by forgotten words and bonds. Oh, the ink stains that are dried upon some pine that keeps you in the back roads by the rivers of my memory, keeps you ever gentle on my mind.
Fantastic. This has been Max Flight from the Airplane Geeks podcast, reporting for Sun and Fun Radio at Sun and Fun 21.
As you know, we generally try to avoid political issues on this podcast because, well, we all get too much of that elsewhere. So the final piece may be a little controversial. Consider this an opinion piece where our main man, Micah, tells us his personal views about sustainable fuel for aviation. Sit back, relax, listen, and remember, it's always a bad idea to reply to someone's opinion while you're still hot. Okay, ready?
Before I go much further, let me just say that this little piece is probably going to offend someone. No, not a good way to start one of my diatribes, but better to tell you at the beginning than leave you with a bad taste in your mouth. That's not to say the bad taste in your mouth won't still be there, but at least you'll know it's possible ahead of time. Consider this my personal potential side effects notice, like in prescription pharmaceutical commercials. Possible side effects of continuing to listen may annoy and anger some individuals. Feelings of fury, rage, or simple annoyance may not be uncommon, and a bad taste may be left in the listener's mouth. Other listeners have reported feelings of joy and elation, appreciating the humor, logic, and even perhaps some of the sarcasm contained herein. So with that in mind, consider yourself warned. And let me say ahead of time, sorry if I irked you. But if you are irked, don't get so deep into it that you can't hear what I'm trying to say. Lastly, bear in mind this is going to be long, most likely too long if I'm honest about it. There are probably many full podcasts that discuss this very topic in more detail and with more authority than I can muster. But if you pay attention, you'll see my intentions are sincere and offered without malice. So what am I talking about? The whole idea of airlines and sustainable power, electric or hydrogen-powered aircraft, carbon offsets, or becoming carbon neutral. What a bunch of happy horse chips. I feel like I'm walking around the Spurwing Farm fly-in as I try to dodge them. Recently, we've had a lot of discussion here on the Airplane Geeks podcast about what is often referred to as alternative-powered aircraft, or perhaps more often called environmentally friendly power or sustainable fuels. Generally, it's electric-powered aircraft we speak of, sometimes hydrogen, and then there always seems to be news of biofuel. Remember the headline? Delta Airlines vows to become carbon neutral by the end of the decade. The story read, Chief Executive Ed Bastian said in a news release that the initiative will focus on harnessing clean flight technologies and carbon emission reduction, among other things. Those efforts include upgrading Delta's aircraft fleet to newer, more fuel-efficient models and use biofuel. Delta will also continue to invest in carbon offset programs, rebuilding forestry and other natural habitats that may be damaged by jet engine emissions, but hopefully on a more limited basis. The whole concept of carbon offsets is based on inductive reasoning. Here's my favorite all-time example of inductive reasoning. God is love. Love is blind. Ray Charles is blind. Therefore, Ray Charles is God. Well, it doesn't quite work that way. By the way, I found that little ditty on the wall of a bathroom stall in the philosophy department as an undergraduate. It stuck with me. Let's remember Newton's first law. Energy can neither be created nor destroyed, but only transferred from one state to another. That's what I like to call the rule of the free lunch. Burning fuel in an aircraft engine at 30,000 feet cannot be offset by planting a tree. It reminds me of the Enrollment Act of 1863 that allowed a draftee to pay a substitute enrollee the sum of $300, about $5,000 in modern times, in order to enlist in his place. Not quite the same thing as universal conscription. Although both are useful, they are hardly interchangeable. Before we delve into sustainable fuels, let's look at current efficiency. According to the U.S. Department of Energy's Alternative Fuels Data Center, after intercity rail, airlines are the most efficient of passenger fuel use based on the average per passenger fuel economy by travel mode. Airlines have a passenger mile per gasoline equivalent of 51.7. Intercity rail, the highest average is 56.6. Light trucks and cars average to 37.8. It seems air travel is not such a polluter compared to other forms of transportation. And what are we going to do? Stop people from traveling completely? Now let's take a look at carbon offsets. Seriously, will planting or maintaining a forest in Indonesia or Brazil really make a difference and truly change the amount of carbon pumped into the atmosphere? The answer can vary from maybe to probably not. If you get a chance, take a listen to the National Public Radio show or podcast, Planet Money, from May 7, with the title, Emission Impossible. The basic answer is, carbon offsets can work under a very specific set of circumstances. Circumstances that currently do not exist. If a forest is maintained forever, and I repeat, forever, it is possible that it might offset some current carbon emissions. But once one of those trees is cut down, left to die, or burns in a fire, the offset is gone. Carbon offsets are a game of smoke and mirrors, something that gives you the illusion that you're doing some good, but look at it long term and poof, it's gone. Carbon offsets offer the illusion of doing good, but like many other things, is merely wishful thinking. We've talked about hydrogen power before on the show. Yes, it's possible to use hydrogen for some forms of power, but it's not easy for many reasons. Hydrogen power, like nuclear fusion, lighter than air transport, and flying cars, are among many technological breakthroughs that are always less than a decade away. The interesting thing about these claims is that I've been reading or hearing them for a bit over half a century now, since before I was in the fifth grade. Setting aside the Hindenburg, which was an anomaly and no reason to dismiss hydrogen, there are various reasons why hydrogen is not really viable. Perhaps the most important is that it's not particularly energy dense. Sure, we can pressurize hydrogen, even liquefy it, but then it gets heavy with holding tanks or Dewar's flasks in which it needs to be stored. Assuming we can overcome weight and energy density issues, we still need to produce the hydrogen itself. The current, most cost-effective way of doing this is by stripping the hydrogen from natural gas, methane. Creating hydrogen from a fossil fuel has us using the very thing we're trying to eliminate. See the smoke and mirrors at play again? Okay, yes, there are other ways to produce hydrogen. There's been work on a microbe-based system. When certain bacteria are exposed to sunlight, they produce hydrogen as other plants would produce oxygen. Then there's some means to reclaim hydrogen from what is gently referred to as biomass, or what, in the not-quite vernacular, we might call sewer waste. Large-scale industrial versions of these methods are down the pike and should be available within the next decade. That has a familiar ring to it. And of course, the one way to produce hydrogen that you may be most familiar with is electrolysis. No, I'm not talking about hair removal. In this case, electrolysis is running a DC electric current through a material to create a non-spontaneous chemical reaction. I remember a gadget we had in my 8th grade science lab. We connected the leads from a transformer to this strange vessel filled with water, and we got oxygen out of one side and hydrogen out of the other. But all of these hydrogen production methods require electricity. Lots and lots and lots of electricity. And where do we get the electricity from? That's a good question. Basically, we have five choices: fossil fuels, nuclear power, water power, wind power, and photovoltaic solar power. Now, there are a few places in the world where geothermal or solar thermal power is used to generate electricity. Iceland is best known for the former, although you can find some all over the world. Spain, China, and the southwest USA are best known for the latter. These types of electric power plants are rare and location-dependent, so I won't be speaking of them here, except to mention they do exist. So let's take a quick look at the five big sources of electricity. Fossil fuels are out. Sure, natural gas burns clean, cleaner than any other fossil fuel, but it's still fossil fuel, and we've been told we can't use that any longer. Plus, these days, most natural gas is collected by fracking, a technique that seems to be especially frowned upon by environmentalists. Then there's nuclear power. That's power generated by a fission reaction. It's safe and clean, but it gets a bad rap from the few problems we've had with it over the years. You know the names: Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima. Chernobyl was the worst, caused by mismanagement and poor design. It was also a perfect storm of public relations. In some ways, Three Mile Island was a success, showing that there were contingencies in place to handle a potential disaster. We learned a lot at Three Mile Island, including a lot about CRM, crew resource management. Fukushima was a weather event. A tsunami or tidal wave surged over the defense of the power plant and flooded the reactors. It will take at least 40 years and about $10 billion to finally get it cleaned up. Nuclear power can be safe, though. Want an example of just how safe? Since the launch of the USS Nautilus in 1954, the U.S. Navy has safely and without incident built, run, and decommissioned hundreds of nuclear reactors that have been and still are used both on surface ships and submarines. Additionally, nuclear power plant technologies have changed and improved considerably since the most recent one was built in the USA. The Watts Bar reactors in Tennessee were designed almost 50 years ago. Yes, the second Watts Bar reactor only came online in 2016, but it was designed in 1973 based on technology of the 1960s. Now, I won't go into details about the advances in nuclear technology here, but if you want to learn about it, take a listen to our friend Marcus Volter and his Omega Tau podcast, episode 359, Modern Fission Reactors. Now, I know you and about a million environmentalists may start screaming, but what about the waste? Nuclear waste disposal is a disaster waiting to happen. That's not exactly true. We have the means to safely dispose or store nuclear waste. The issue is more of a NIMBY thing. NIMBY, you ask? Not in my backyard. Nobody wants to live near a nuclear waste facility, even if it's safe and clean and not emitting radiation. Want to know more about nuclear waste disposal? Just head back to Marcus Volter and Omega Tau, this time episode 368, Nuclear Waste Disposal and Storage. If people would open their minds, nuclear energy could be a viable solution. In fact, as I'm writing this and checking ISO New England, 29% of the electricity on the grid that I'm using right now is coming from nuclear power. 53% is coming from natural gas. The other 18% is coming from a combination of hydro and, to quote the site, renewables. Let's talk about renewables for a minute. People hear renewable and think clean and green. That's not always correct. Here in Maine, renewables include wood-fired boilers. Not really a clean source of energy by any means. First, you harvest trees out of a forest, transport them to a processing plant, and then transport that processed wood to the electric generating facility that gives off emissions from burning the wood. No carbon offset here. In fact, maybe this is the time to talk a little bit about biofuels. First, let's set a definition. Biofuel, sustainable fuel, SAF, short for sustainable aviation fuel, it's all the same thing. What is it? Well, for one thing, it's not truly sustainable. It's simply non-petroleum synthesized or refined fuel. The headlines about this airline and that airline running an engine on biofuel drives me crazy. Biofuel burns no differently than fossil fuel. Sure, it's refined from different stuff, usually waste food oils from commercial fryers, but it burns like any other fuel and puts out pretty much the same emissions. Biofuel has been used for years, mostly in diesel engines, although diesel fuel, Jet A and kerosene are all pretty much the same thing. The engine typically doesn't know or care where it came from as long as it's the same refinement and combusts the same way. It's no big deal or great environmental savings to burn biofuel, other than it doesn't come out of the ground. There was once a news story about a biofuel diesel truck that everyone loved because the exhaust smelled just like cooking French fries. Chips for those of you in the UK. And as long as we're talking about biofuel, let's discuss growing and harvesting it. Here in the USA, we have 10% ethanol in our gasoline in most states. This ethanol is refined from corn. It's said to make the engine burn cleaner, and it may. But the added ethanol also lowers gas mileage, so more gasoline is burned to drive the same distance, creating more exhaust. But wait, there's more. The corn used in distilling ethanol needs to be grown with fertilizer and often with pesticides. Where does the fertilizer and pesticides come from? Natural gas. If we're using all this fossil fuel to create these biofuels, where's the carbon offset? It's like tearing down the house to find wood to throw in the fireplace to stay warm. We're turning our food into fuel thinking it's going to save the environment. Talk about no free lunch. Now let's move on to the others. Water, wind, and photovoltaic solar. Water power is perhaps the simplest and most ancient. Dam up a moving body of water, create a reserve, let it out a little at a time, and we can spin a wheel, or in modern times, a turbine. It works well, and is comparatively easy to do. Well, until you get into the details. People tend to complain that a dammed up river is a travesty. It destroys nature. It can and has displaced people. And one of my favorite complaints, it's not pretty. Yes, dams can put pressure on both Anatropis and Catadromis migrating fish populations. Those are fish that either spawn in freshwater, then live in saltwater, or the reverse. But dams can be built that allow for fish migration. Displacing people for the common good can be a tragedy, but does sometimes need to happen. That's why there are eminent domain laws that are applied judiciously. Then there's the issue of transmission lines. There's been a huge fight going on for years in the Northeast USA about power lines. Hydro-Québec is trying to send excess hydroelectric power generated in Quebec, Canada, to ISO New England, the electric grid that powers the 6 New England states in the USA. So far, the building of the transmission lines required to do this has been turned down in Vermont and New Hampshire. There's a big fight going on in Maine right now. The lines would run through the middle of nowhere, truly affecting nothing. But the basic argument comes down to aesthetics. That's right. The discussion against it is, it doesn't look pretty to me. It destroys the view. In Maine, I'm sorry to say, many dams are being removed by those who believe they destroy the natural beauty of nature, taking away already existent incredibly green power from the grid. This can be frustrating in so many ways. I think back to an aphorism of one of my favorite authors, Robert Heinlein, who in 1973, in his book, Time Enough for Love, wrote, "There are hidden contradictions in the minds of people who love nature while deploring the artificialities with which man has spoiled nature. The obvious contradiction lies in their choice of words, which imply that man and his artifacts are not part of nature, but beavers and their dams are. But the contradiction goes deeper than this prima facie absurdity. In declaring his love for a beaver dam erected by beavers for beaver purposes, and his hatred for dams erected by men for the purposes of men, the naturist reveals his hatred for his own race, i.e., his own self-hatred. The aphorism goes on and gets even more controversial, but you get the gist. There are two other forms of hydropower that need to be mentioned, river turbines and tidal power. I don't think I need to go into much more detail, except to also say that like nuclear fusion and the other aforementioned promised technologies, projects like these have been promised by the end of the decade for almost a century now. Wind power comes with some of the same problems as hydropower, transmission lines, and aesthetics. As with all power, generating electricity is not the only issue. The electricity needs to get where it can be used. Where the wind tends to blow consistently is generally not near electric grid substations, and power lines need to be run. So all the transmission line problems I spoke of before come into play again. While personally, I find wind turbines graceful and beautiful, many think they ruin the landscape and keep away tourists. Now, for centuries, tourists have been traveling to the Netherlands to see the windmills, but apparently, according to those that oppose wind power, that doesn't count. Another issue with wind power is modern wind turbines can generate a lot of noise, including very low-frequency noise that travels great distances and is often felt rather than heard. Having lived in urban areas all my life, I'm not sure if I would notice it. But most wind turbines are located in rural areas with rural populations who have never lived near a train or an airport, let alone in a city. So the noise can be a new intrusion. Then there are low levels of infrasound and LFN, low-frequency noise, that is said to be registered by the nervous system and affect the body, even though they can't be heard. I've never experienced it, but there are many who have and complain about it. Some say wind turbines destroy migrating bird populations the way dams stop migratory fish. I'm sure we could find statistics that could be used both for and against this notion. Okay, so how about we move the wind turbines offshore? Put them out at sea, so they're out of the way. No problem with infrasound and LFN. Well, maybe it would eliminate the sound problems, but the aesthetic issue continues. That was a fight Ted Kennedy put up in the U.S. Senate for many years, when the only recently approved Vineyard Wind project was first proposed. But there are still more issues with offshore wind projects. The fishing industry hates them and fights against them vigorously. There's no proof at all that offshore wind projects would harm the fishing industry. In fact, there are far better arguments that it would aid it, as the wind turbine bases would serve as artificial reefs. However, the fishing industry still fights against all offshore wind projects. In fact, here in Maine, a 10-year moratorium has just been put in place for wind projects located in state waters. With all of that, we haven't even covered the most critical problem with wind, the one we really can't overcome. Wind power is inconsistent. Sure, we can come up with averages and numbers that will show that for this amount of time, we should get this much wind and generate this much power. But we have those same averages about earthquakes, hurricanes, and rainfall. Yet we still have Fukushima, Hurricane Maria, and California wildfires. The electric grid needs a consistent amount of power. Too much, and it will shut down due to overloads. You see, electricity is a thing. It's energy, and cannot just be made to disappear. Electricity needs to be used, transferred to another state or form. Electricity doesn't just dissipate. Remember Newton's first law? If there's too little electricity on the grid, it will shut down from there being too much draw. That's one reason why gas-fired power plants are so critical to the electric grid. If there are immediate needs, they can be fired up and running in very little time. And if there's too much electricity hitting the grid, they can be shut down even more quickly. So we need to get on to photovoltaic solar power, which I'll be referring to as just solar power, or solar. Solar power also suffers from some of the problems I've mentioned before: transmission lines, aesthetics, and inconsistency. It's only available at peak during the day when it's clear. But let's put those aside for now. There are a couple of additional issues with solar. Solar cells use rare earth elements that could include neodymium, dysprosium, indium, selenium, tellurium, terbium, and gallium. No, I'm not naming planets or species from Star Trek. These are rare earth elements found on the periodic table. These elements are only available in a small handful of countries. they need to be mined, and mining can mean runoff and destruction. The majority of rare earth elements are mined in China, almost 60%. Next is the USA, with 16% or so. After that, Burma, often referred to as Myanmar, then Australia and Madagascar. The amount drops down to less than 2% after that. According to a Yale School of the Environment study, mining of rare earth elements damaged surface vegetation, caused soil erosion, pollution, and acidification, and reduced or even eliminated food crop output, and typically produces wastewater with a high concentration of radioactive residues. It seems solar power is starting to look a bit less environmentally friendly. But wait, there's still more about solar power. Solar power panels reflect heat back into the atmosphere. According to a study published by The Conversation on February 11, 2021, that was conducted by Lund University and the Hawkesbury Institute for the Environment at Western Sydney University, quote, "While the black surfaces of solar panels absorb most of the sunlight that reaches them, only a fraction, around 15% of that incoming energy, gets converted to electricity. The rest is returned to the environment as heat. The panels are usually much darker than the ground they cover, so the vast expanse of solar cells will absorb a lot of additional energy and emit it as heat, affecting the climate," unquote. Isn't this exactly the kind of global warming we are trying to stop by seeking alternative energy? Doesn't seem to be a free lunch here. Okay, one last thing. I've talked about biofuels for aircraft power, and I've discussed hydrogen power. That led us to the need for electricity, which led us here. But we missed battery power. Plain old electric-powered aircraft that don't require long extension cords. This topic seems to be in the news about every day. So let's talk a minute about battery technology. Many people don't realize that batteries don't store electricity. In fact, one of the problems in generating electricity is that there is really no means to store it. Let's go back to Newton's first law. Energy can neither be created nor destroyed, but only transferred from one state to another. Not being able to store electricity isn't exactly true. Capacitors can sort of store it, and supercapacitors are a technology that in certain circumstances show promise. But we'll save that for another time. When we generate electricity, we're transforming energy from one form to another, then transforming the energy into something other than electricity when the electricity appears to be stored. Generally, electricity is produced mechanically, the generators you think about when you think of power plants. Electricity can also be created through the photovoltaic effect of solar panels, or generated chemically in a fuel cell or battery. No, batteries don't store electricity. They chemically generate it. When a battery is recharged, the chemical reaction that generates the electricity is being reversed, which allows the battery to generate electricity again. This is the charge-discharge cycle. Eventually, chemicals wear, change form, or dissipate, or the internal battery grid corrodes. Batteries have a limited number of charge-discharge cycles, which is why they eventually wear out. Most rechargeable batteries use lithium. You've probably all heard of lithium-ion batteries. There's probably one within a foot of you right now. But here's the problem with lithium. It's mined, much of it in China. Another good portion in what's known as the Lithium Triangle, where Chile, Argentina, and Bolivia meet in South America. I won't go into details, but as recently mentioned in Rare Earth Elements, the whole mining process is an environmental disaster. And let's not get into the political problems that could come about if things heat up with China. But okay, what if we could mine huge quantities of lithium in the USA? Well, we can, or we could. There are huge deposits of lithium in Nevada, except for the fact that the open-pit lithium mine proposed there by Australian mining company Ioneer Corp would destroy most of the global habitat for TM's buckwheat, putting it on a path to extinction, and the permits for the mine have been blocked. That's okay. There's a plan at the Salton Sea in California to extract lithium salt from a hot liquid pumped up from an aquifer more than 4,000 feet below the surface. The process would be powered by geothermal power plants, generating emission-free electricity. Except this project would use billions of gallons of valuable groundwater, contaminating it for 300 years, and at the same time leave behind giant mounds of waste. More smoke and mirrors, my friends. So maybe Thomas Malthus was right, but not about food production, about energy production. Perhaps the Earth's population is too great to create enough energy to feed it, while also maintaining a livable environment for the entire population. We shall soon see, because if we don't come up with a solution, we'll come to see a massive population die-off from many unpleasant factors and many difficult choices. This may be time for another one of Robert Heinlein's aphorisms. Throughout history, poverty is the normal condition of man. Advances, which permit this norm to be exceeded here and there, now and then, are the work of an extremely small minority, frequently despised, often condemned, and almost always opposed by all right-thinking people. Whenever this tiny minority is kept from creating, or, as sometimes happens, is driven out of society, the people then slip back into abject poverty. Are you depressed yet? Well, I am. But not about what you may think has me down. Not by the technology. Not by the circle of problems I've described. But by how the general public most often cannot see through the smoke and mirrors. And by how too many people, smart people, groups and individuals I admire, are still looking for a free lunch. You may have heard the phrase that was popularized by Mark Twain and often wrongly attributed to British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli and or American humorist Will Rogers. There are three kinds of lies. Lies, damn lies, and statistics. We need to remember this when we look at the claims, at the justifications, and especially when we look at the numbers. We can't allow ourselves to be fooled or even wooed by smoke and mirrors, and we need to stop looking for a free lunch. When we're making decisions about energy, we need to think and analyze the process dynamically. Static analysis may produce good short-term results, but will never give us the true long-term outcome. Our leaders, our politicians, and even our energy and environmental advocates never speak dynamically and hardly ever think dynamically. That's what depresses me. I'm not depressed or upset about the holes in the current technology. Don't you be either. We can find the technology we need given time and money. That's not the issue. But do we have the time and the money? Perhaps not. Are there going to be huge global changes? Yes. But that's the nature of life, of species. So how do we save the world, save the environment, and stop global warming? I don't know. Perhaps we can't. It could be inevitable. And although human beings may have helped it to take place, it could be happening without us. It could be one of those things that we don't quite fully understand. Perhaps we see correlations and assume causation because the cause has not yet been discovered. I'm not what are often referred to as a denier, just the opposite. But I don't believe there's a grand solution. There may be a lot of little solutions that could add up, though. For example, why do we allow a multimillion-dollar for-profit corporation to draw water from artesian wells belonging to municipal water companies using state of Maine aquifers, then truck that water all over the state to bottling plants, package it in petrochemical bottles, and then ship it all over the world as spring water from a mythical town in Maine that might be called, oh, say, Poland? But the worst part, we believe the advertising and think that it's healthier and more pure than the EPA-certified water coming from a local tap. I have another question. Why do we collect some of our garbage and rename it recycling? We have it picked up by special trucks to transport it to a local plant where it's sorted into shipping containers. Those shipping containers are then trucked to ports where they're loaded on ships and sent to China or some third world country, only to find out it's still really just garbage, and it's either going to a landfill or being sent back. Out of sight, out of mind. Yes, it's true. Some things can be recycled into other things, and we may get some use out of them again. But believe it or not, most plastics are really one-time use only. I mean, remember, what are plastics? They're petrochemicals. Fossil fuel by any other name. But here's the kicker. Polyethylene, terephthalate, or PET, soda bottles, the type of plastic labeled with a number 1, it's easily recycled. It's made into clothing, polyester. You're probably wearing some now, or walking on it in a carpet. You can get one more use out of PET. How do you like the taste of it? Did you know you were eating plastic? Yes, you are, in microparticles. When you wash your clothes, microparticles of polyester come off in the wash. They head through the sewer systems of the world and are too small to be filtered out. The microparticles are eventually flushed into the ocean and move up the food chain until we're eating them ourselves. I suppose my point is if we can stop enough of the little things, the ones marketed to us either directly or through corporate lobbyists, we might be able to start a major change. When we try to get too grandiose all at once, there are going to be huge unforeseen consequences as I've been describing. So be skeptical, be rational, and don't be influenced by emotion when it comes to matters of science. Also, and very specifically, without wishing to offend, never forget there's a huge difference between beliefs, faith, or religion, and science. Science can be proven over and over again in double-blind studies. Once again, from the same one of his books I quoted before, Robert Heinlein may have said it best when he wrote, "The difference between science and fuzzy subjects is that science requires reasoning, while those other subjects merely require scholarship." Don't be taken in by emotional pleas. Greta Thunberg, an environmental activist who is now 18 years old, has a very precious heart. And while I'm not trying to disparage her, bear in mind, she's also been diagnosed with depression, Asperger's syndrome, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and selective mutism. But she focused these abilities into something that we may see as productive. But is she appealing to our emotions or our logic? If she were not young and waif-like, would she have gotten any attention? If an old, ugly person like me came along with the same message, would we hear the message differently? Is the message rational, or are we just feeling guilty from an emotional appeal? Remember in the beginning I said I was probably going to offend someone? By now I probably have, and I'm sorry if I did. But that's why I put that little disclaimer in before I started. So please, before you start screaming at me, remember you were warned. So what's the answer? I don't know. Maybe there isn't a solution. Maybe there is, but it hasn't yet been discovered. So we need to keep looking for it. Keep the search going and be open to discussion. But please, always keep Newton's first law in mind. It applies to more than just energy. Look for the smoke and mirrors. And maybe more importantly, never forget, there's no such thing as a free lunch. For the Airplane Geeks, here in Portland, Maine, this is your main man, Micah.
Well, that's it for this Bits and Pieces episode. We hope you enjoyed it. In 2 weeks, we'll return to our usual format. Meantime, find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/655. And our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And please join us again when we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.